also have one lost and found announcement. At the potluck, somebody left a knife at Mel and Donna's house, and so I'm going to put this on the piano. If anybody recognizes it as a knife that you brought to the potluck, it's yours.
Well, Happy New Year to all of you, and I see that we got some good treats over there, too. So I, too, wanted to thank this class for their generous gift towards me and Kathy, and I want to let you know, too, that the church matched that and had us give that amount to, they said, you know, who in your ministry would you like to reach out to? And there are several pastors in Africa. They've been wanting to be equipped with resources that they couldn't afford, so they're getting a nice package. So thank you all for making that happen. So, and we do have some 2010 calendars over there on the table, and you can have one or more if you wish for a donation of any amount to Reasons to Believe. We just have a few of those left. And people have been asking me if I could please let you know when I am going to be on KKLA. I get on about once a month. Typically, they don't tell me that I'm going to be on until just hours before. So, but I actually have advance notice. I'll be on tomorrow at 4 p.m. So if you can catch that time, that's fine. A couple of scientific announcements here before we get into finishing up Psalm 104 and jumping into Psalm 139. I'm going to try to alternate, like I mentioned last week, where we start off with a scientific discovery, but the following week we start off with the biblical studies. You may have heard about this. I don't know how many in the class have ever heard of the asteroid Apophis. Okay, a few of you have. All right. It was discovered in 2004. And got quite a bit of attention back then because NASA scientists at that time had calculated that in the year 2029, it had a 1 in 37 chance of colliding with the Earth. And 1 in 37 is a fairly significant risk. And this thing isn't tiny. It's 885 feet across. And just to give you some context for that, a rock 100 feet in diameter crashed into Arizona 10,000 years ago and blew out a crater nearly a mile in diameter and 350 feet deep with the explosive equivalent of the bomb that knocked out Hiroshima. That was 100 feet across. This thing that's 885 feet across, that's about 730 times more explosive power. And so if that were to hit in a populated area, it would do a lot of damage. However, NASA has since done more extensive studies on this asteroid Apophis and have downgraded the probability of it colliding with the Earth in 2029 to one chance in a quarter of a million. But that's not the end of the risks. There's also going to be a close encounter of Apophis with the Earth in the year 2032, 2035, and 2058. And in each case, the probability of a collision is roughly one chance in a quarter of a million. Now, this hasn't bothered NASA too much, but the Russians are concerned. They're saying probabilities that high are things we routinely insure against. And that is true. I mean, we do take out insurance against risks that actually are lower than one chance in a quarter of a million. And so the Russians are saying we need to prepare to knock this thing out of the way so that it won't be a risk at all to planet Earth. And they're thinking the best time to knock it out of the way is 2029 because NASA's best calculations tell us it's going to come within 18,000 miles of the Earth. That's a fairly close encounter, which means it wouldn't be that expensive to send a spaceship up there to hit it with a good whack and then knock it out of the way. And so Russia just announced this Thursday that it intended to, pardon me, Wednesday, that it intended to prepare a mission to knock Apophis out of the way when it makes a close encounter in 2029. NASA got a little bit concerned about this because, you know, Apophis is not a billiard ball. And I don't know how many of you ever played pool or billiards. I mean, I thought, well, you know, since I'm a physics student, I've taken classical mechanics, I should be really good at pool. Because actually I can use my Lagrangian physics to calculate exactly where to hit that ball to make it go the direction I want it to go. Well, there's that too. But you know, it's one thing to know the physics of where to hit it and how to put spin on it. It's quite another matter to actually make that collision with that stick. It takes a lot of skill to hit it where you're... And that's the thing, I got very frustrated with playing pool because I could never hit the ball at the right spot or with the right velocity to do what I was able to calculate I wanted it to do. So simply knowing the mathematics doesn't really give you an advantage in pool. In fact, it probably gives you less than an advantage because here you are calculating the math when you really should be practicing on how to hit that thing just the right way. So I didn't do very well at pool, but likewise NASA's concern that the Russians might not do too well at pool. Because in order to make this thing go the direction you want it to go, you got to hit it just right, with just the right mass at just the right velocity in just the right direction. And the biggest problem is that Apophis is not a billiard ball. It's not a perfectly round sphere of a perfectly even density. Its density varies throughout its interior, and moreover, it doesn't have a spherical shape. Perfectly spherical shape. So when you hit it, who knows where it's going to go? And it could actually wind up raising that probability from one chance in a quarter of a million down to, say, one chance in 10, or maybe a certainty, where instead of bouncing it out of the way, it comes crashing into the Earth. And, of course, people are wondering, you know, are the Russians going to actually hit the thing in such a way that it's going to smash into Washington, D.C., rather than going off in some opposite direction? Can we really trust the Russians to hit that thing the right way? Well, NASA's whole point is you hit that thing with a spacecraft, there's no telling where it's going to go. And we're actually better off doing nothing.
Is that Russian?
You could call that Russian roulette. Thank you. Need a little bit of humor for the new year? But what NASA's actually come up with, they say, okay, if you insist on doing something rather than doing nothing, they're recommending doing nothing because they're saying, you know, just let it swing by. The risk is low enough. Let's not worry about it. And we're probably going to raise the risk rather than lower the risk if we try to hit it. But their whole point and message to the Russians is if you do insist on doing something, the safest thing to do, and the Russians have been very circumspect in saying to the public, we're not going to blow it up with a nuclear device. You know, there's been a couple of movies out, right, with astronauts go up to an asteroid and blow it up with a nuclear device. Well, scientists all over the world know that's the worst thing you can do. Because when you blow the thing up, you got a lot of pieces. And now you've got many pieces instead of one piece. And the probability might be 1.25 million for each piece. But if you got lots of pieces, that sends the probability up quite high that at least one or more of those pieces will crash into the Earth. You're really better off not blowing it apart. Moreover, if you're using nuclear weaponry, now you've got nasty stuff falling towards the Earth, radioactive stuff rather than just big rocks. But NASA's actually come up with a way to do this with safety, if you insist to do it at all. And that would be to send a really heavy spaceship up towards this Apophis asteroid, and instead of hitting it, you orbit it. And if you orbit it with a sufficiently heavy spaceship, the gravity of the spaceship will tug on the asteroid. And so by carefully adjusting the orbit, you can gradually pull the thing away from the Earth. It takes a lot more time, but it can be done with safety. And if you make a mistake in, say, calculating the mass distribution of Apophis, you can correct it. Whereas if you just slam into the thing and make a mistake, there's no correcting it. But, you know, if you make one orbit and I say, oh, it's going towards the Earth, then you can make an orbital adjustment and move it away from the Earth. You can kind of do a trial and error thing until you get it just right and then gradually tug it away from the Earth, and then everything would be safe. So, in that sense, we do have a good solution. However, it would cost you a little more money because the Russian plan is to send a relatively small spaceship and then hit it with high velocity. Because the force with which you cause the planet to move away is proportional to the mass times the velocity squared. And so you can send a much smaller spaceship and just have it hit the asteroid at a much faster velocity. But the American plan is send a really heavy spaceship and you don't have to worry about the velocity. A slow velocity is just fine because all you want to do is orbit the thing and then tug it away. But it will cost you more money because now you're looking at a heavier spaceship. But still, NASA bottom line is saying one chance in a quarter of a million, let's just do nothing. And if the probability gets higher for, say, 2032, then we can do something. Because right now we have a probability of 1.25 million for 2029. Roughly that probability for 2032, 2035, and 2058. But we don't know until we have the first encounter. After the first encounter, we'll be able to calculate the probabilities for the next three with great precision. And then we'll know what to do. But the Russians are quite firm in saying, we're going. We don't care about the Americans. It kind of reminds me of the Cold War. We don't care about the rest of the world. We're going to do what we can to protect Moscow from being hit. And so this may force the Americans to say, okay, we're going to go there first with a heavy spaceship. And if it doesn't work, then you Russians can do something. But we can pull it away. So it looks like the taxpayer is going to get stuck with a bill that we really weren't wanting to pay in the first place. But it is interesting that they have come up with a brand new safe way to take care of asteroids that are coming in a near encounter. As NASA has pointed out, this isn't the only asteroid that could pose a risk, but it does pose the biggest risk of any asteroid that we know of. Okay, there's a question over here, and then I'll come back here. Yes?
I was just wondering, I never hear a proposal like if you want to conserve the total mass and fuel that you have to put up there after all the expense is, if you don't have a three-part lander that establishes each unit favorably, so they have three-axis control, and then have very small rocket engines with very high injection velocity, so over a period of time, a year or so, they can deliver a very significant impulse that would be non-destructive and very controlled. But I don't see why they always talk about these crude methods. That seems, like you pointed out, there's such a serious drawback. It seemed like that approach would minimize all the resources to do it that way.
Well, that's kind of NASA's argument, that there's a better and safer way to do it. So, I mean, you don't have to touch the thing at all. Just orbit it. Well, it's kind of what we've been mentioning in our study in the book of Job, is that the human tendency is always to come up with a quick and dirty way to solve our problems. And the Russians are excited because they said, we have found something that's better than the quick and dirty method, which is to hit it rather than to try to blow it up with nuclear devices. That was the quick and dirty method. They said, we've got a better method. But NASA is now stepping in saying, we have a better method yet. But it will cost a little bit more money. And we're not sure the money's worth the risk at this point, is what they're saying. Well, the advantage of just orbiting it rather than sending a bunch of spacecraft and trying to rocket it away is to rocket it away, you need a fair amount of force. And number two, orbiting something is a lot cheaper mission. That's the cheapest space mission of all, is to send something up to orbit a body. But when you're trying to land on the body and, you know, then do things with it once you land on the body, now you're into more expense. And once again, if you're using rockets and trying to push the thing away, you could easily make mistakes. What NASA's pointing out is the orbit method is the safest method of all. Because you're not using any propellant. You're not having to land on the thing. You're just simply orbiting it. And also, orbital mathematics is something we can calculate to very high precision. And so we, you know, it's really the safest and most accurate way to deal with the problem.
Besides, it gives JPL a mission.
Pardon me?
It gives JPL a mission to do.
It gives JPL a mission to do, that's true. So, and it's something that JPL is very good at. They're very good at being able to precisely place bodies in particular orbits. And so they've had a lot of experience with this. So bottom line, they're saying, if you're really worried about Apophis, this is the way to do it. So, over here.
What effect does Jupiter have on the path of the asteroids? Will it eventually absorb it, just like it did Shoemaker-Levy 9?
Well, that's the Russian argument, is that NASA's saying one chance in a quarter of a million, but you know this isn't a two-body problem. You can calculate these things to very high precision if you're dealing with two-point sources that are orbiting one another a fair distance apart from one another. That's something we routinely teach our students in classical mechanics. And you can calculate the movement and the positions with very high accuracy if you're only dealing with two bodies. If you're dealing with multiple bodies, then you have to approximate everything. You cannot do an exact solution. And so what NASA does, they use supercomputers to try to come up with the best approximate solution possible. And, you know, their initial calculation was a risk of one chance in 37. But as they began to do more measurements of the position of Apophis and also bring in the factors of the gravitational influence of the other planets in our solar system, they came up with a better approximation, one chance in a quarter of a million. But that is subject to change because, you know, this is not exact science. And with the more bodies, because you got the moon you got to worry about, you have, because this thing's going to pass within 18,000 miles of the Earth. And so basically you've got a three-body problem. The gravity of the sun is important. The gravity of Earth is important. The gravity of the moon is important. To a much lesser degree, the gravity of Jupiter is important. And then you likewise, you've got Saturn, other bodies to take into account. But right now, you've got a four-body problem that's difficult to solve. Three massive bodies, all having a significant gravitational influence on this Apophis. So, these probabilities are subject to change. However, as we're getting better and better data, the probabilities are getting more and more remote. That's something else that NASA's pointing out. Right now, the probability is one chance in a quarter of a million, but the trend line is that the probabilities are getting more remote as we learn more. That's why they're recommending we do nothing. Yes.
That was kind of tying into my question is, when do they plan to do this, either American or Russian plan, and won't we get a lot more information about, between now and then, about what these probabilities are? You said we had to wait till after the 2029 to get any information about
the future ones.
So are we looking at saying whether or not the 2029 number goes away, we still have to do this maneuver in order to deal with the ones after that?
Well, the Russian argument is we're going to take care of this if no one else will. And I think what that's going to do is force the Americans to step in ahead and say, well, let's at least try the orbital thing first before you try to, you know, push it away. But the Russians are on record as saying, we're going. Whatever else the international community wants to think about this. And right now, I think what we're going to see is a significant diplomatic maneuver to talk the Russians out of it. But right now, the Russians are on public notice, we're going.
And like what time frame have they said, though?
Well, in 2029 is, what, 19 years away. And so they say, we've got 19 years to get ready for this thing.
Well, they're going to actually send this out when it's at its closest approach in
2029. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the plan, that when it's at its closest approach, they're going to try to hit it just right. So, okay.
I would be very worried, obviously, when I was talking about Mars, obviously, you know, the Russians have a very poor track record. Not a single one of their landers was successful on Mars. They had one successful lander on Venus. and their moon record isn't that great either. So I would be very worried about the Russians doing anything because their success rate is very, very low.
Uh, 18,000 miles is quite a ways from the Earth, but already orbiting around the Earth, we got so much space junk. I read the other day that a satellite actually collided with one of these space junk. That's, and I saw a picture in Discover Mars where it's just surrounded with space junk. So, if we
send a big
right now. If it was a little further out, we wouldn't have to worry about anything crashing into us. It would be crashing into all this junk, you know.
Yeah, I mean, part of the job of NASA is just to monitor the orbits of 10,000 plus pieces of space junk. And they don't bother even trying to calculate the small stuff. They only look at the big stuff. So there's 10,000 pieces of big junk out there, basically dead satellites that are orbiting around the Earth. And that's one scenario. Russia could send this thing up to hit Apophis, and it hits a piece of junk on the way. So that could happen. And by the way, there's actually a verse in the Bible that talks about an asteroid hitting the Earth in the days before the return of Christ. And there's always the possibility that the asteroid hits the Earth as a result of human error. So,
where is that verse?
Revelation 8. But I think it's verse 10 and 11. I think I got it here for you to check out. It's the third of the trumpet disasters that is prophesied to strike the earth. The third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter. And the word for star there is the Greek word aster, which could mean a star, a planet, an asteroid, a comet, or a meteor. All those would qualify under that Greek word aster. And clearly it's not a star or a planet, because that would destroy the Earth. But it could be a comet or an asteroid. And it says it will taint a third of the world's freshwater supply. So this thing, 885 feet across, it would have to have just a very special composition to be able to pull that off. It's barely big enough to fulfill that prophecy. Chances are it's not going to be Apophis. It'll be something a little bit bigger. And it would have to be one of these stainless steel type asteroids in order to do that kind of a poisonous damage to the fresh water. But it could be a human error that does it. In fact, I've often thought that one way that prophecy will be fulfilled are the space agencies of the world recognizing, NASA's already come to this conclusion, that the cheapest way to build stuff in space is not to send raw materials up from the surface of the Earth, but to actually go out into the main asteroid belt and grab a stainless steel asteroid and drag it into Earth orbit. That would reduce the cost of building stuff in space by a factor of 10. It's 10 times cheaper to go out and grab the stainless steel asteroid than to ship steel up from the surface of the Earth. So one scenario is they go out and grab one of these stainless steel asteroids, and obviously they want to grab something fairly big, so they got lots of building material, but in placing it in orbit around the Earth, they make a mistake, and it comes crashing into the Earth. So,
Oops,
we'll see. But who knows how that particular prophecy in Revelation 8 will be fulfilled. We'll see. And there's a lot of speculation. Are there any asteroids out there by the name of Wormwood? Well, Wormwood is a Greek. The word is Artemis, and it's simply a term that refers to bitterness. And therefore, I don't think it's the name of any particular asteroid. It's just simply referring to what's going to happen. Yes, John?
I've long wondered about that verse, and I wonder how it could be associated with some contamination of water supplies in a large area. If it were a celestial object that, rather than something else that represented symbolically or allegorically.
Well, stainless steel asteroids, some of them are loaded with cobalt. And nickel is pretty nasty. I mean, your typical stainless steel asteroid is iron, nickel, and cobalt. And we call them stainless steel because the quantity of cobalt and nickel is so high, it's better than the best grade of stainless steel that we use here on Earth. But cobalt and nickel in high quantities can be poisonous. And then, you know, you could get radioactive cobalt. And that could be a problem as well.
It would have to disperse in the atmosphere before colliding with the surface planet. I'm just wondering how it would be distributed in such a wide. I mean, it implies a third of the...
There's actually one place on planet Earth where you got about a third of the world's fresh water supply all in one locale. So if it hits there, that would take care of it. So in that sense, you can actually calculate where this thing will hit if that's the correct interpretation. Are you interested in what the location is? No, it would be in northeastern British Columbia. What's called the Rocky Mountain Trench. And four of the 10 largest rivers in the world flow out of that area. It's the place where you got the fastest melt of glaciers taking place. So lots of water pour out of there. The second largest river flows out of there, the Mackenzie. The fourth largest, the Fraser, flows out of there. The Columbia flows out of there. The Stickney, a river many of you probably never heard of, nevertheless is a huge water flow. Now, right now, that water is not being used by anybody. It's not being used for irrigation. It's not being used for water power. That water just flows into the oceans untouched by man. But it's the last remaining significant source of fresh water on the planet. And so if the planet became especially thirsty for agricultural purposes, that's the last water we can tap. It's going to make a big difference. And there was even a plan put into effect in 1958 to exploit that water to plant the deserts of North America. So, and you know, but back in 58, they were worried about a worldwide food crisis. Right now, no one's worried about a worldwide food crisis. But if that were ever to become a reality, that's really the only way to significantly increase the world's food supply is to tap into that water. Now you'd have a scenario. So on that basis, I would say, I don't think this asteroid is going to hit soon, because the context of this is it's going to have a significant human impact. If it hits today, it's not going to affect anybody. So we would have to wait till that time where that water is being exploited. So don't worry about the asteroid hitting anytime soon. But maybe by 2029, we'll be tapping into that water. I don't know. Probably not. You're looking at probably a 20, 30-year building project minimum to take advantage of that water. So I think we're okay past 2029. Okay. Yes?
Well, I understand that if you don't do something, isn't this problem going to persist for 300 years, so it's going to keep coming back around?
Apophis makes a close pass by of Earth every 3 years.
But 300 years is going to be a threat to Earth is what I've read.
Yeah, I mean,
different passes, yeah.
Well, I mean, every 3 years you got a new risk. I mean, that's kind of the Russian argument. They're saying the risk may be only 1.25 million now, but this thing keeps coming back every 3 years. And they said, you know, eventually it's going to prove a problem because, you know, you're going to get that kind of a risk taking place every time. And their whole argument is if you wait for 250,000 passbys, then you got a one-on-one chance it's going to hit with the Earth. But that's projecting out, 750,000 years from now. The taxpayer may not be too concerned about events 750,000 years from now. But the Russian argument is if we take care of this, it's a permanent fix. We'll never have to worry about it again. And so NASA's response is there's a better way to do it. Well, you know, that was really only one of the things I want to talk about. The big announcement this week, at least to the scientific community, is a set of papers published in the Astrophysical Journal making the point that the gas giants in our solar system are rare indeed and very probably unique amongst all the planets that exist in the universe. And there's now been 415 planets found outside of our solar system, and it's looking like about 3 or 4% of all the stars in our galaxy have planets. And you know, any spiral galaxy that's still forming stars will likely have a lot of planets. So planets are shaping up to be quite numerous within the universe. But of those 415 planets, none of them are proving to be analogs to the planets in our solar system. And you might say, well, we haven't discovered the tiny ones, but when we look at the big ones that are easy to detect, even here, none of them are like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, or Neptune. And we were talking a few weeks ago about a discovery that the sun's elemental composition is unique. And this is a study done by a group of astronomers that have been spending their life looking for a perfect twin of the sun and basically concluding there are no perfect twins of the sun amongst the stars we see in our galaxy. And they actually came up with an analysis that proved why. It's because when we look at the sun and compare its elemental abundance to stars that come the closest to matching its characteristics, the sun has a high abundance of volatile elements and a low abundance of what they call refractory elements. And then they chalk that up to the fact that the sun has a unique array of planets. Unique in the sense that the gas giants, which are predominantly made up of the volatiles, that's a term for light elements that make up gases like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. Compared to the refractories, which make up the dust and the metals, this would be magnesium, sodium, aluminum, etc. And the point they were making is that what we see special about our solar system compared to these 415 planets, our solar system has several big rocky planets that are in close to the sun, and then several relatively small gas giants that are far away from the sun. And that appears to be unique so far in looking at these extrasolar planets, in that they tend to be big as compared to the case of the gas giants. We're seeing that a lot of them are quite large compared to the gas giants in our solar system, and also closer into the sun or their stars than is the case for the gas giants in our star's planetary system. Well, a brand new study is showing that there's something else that's special about our gas giants, and it's their density. And let me just review for you. This is Jupiter, the biggest of the... maybe we can shut off some of the lights here so you can see this a little better. Is that Jupiter has 317.8 times the mass of the Earth, and the Jupiter all by itself makes up about three-quarters of the mass of all the planets in our solar system. And then its density is 1.326 times that of water. And then the next massive planet is Saturn, which comes in at about three-tenths the mass of Jupiter, 95 times the mass of the Earth. And it's the only planet in our solar system that is less than the density of water. And then we have beyond that Uranus. And you can see here Uranus has its orbital axis going that way. So you can see that the bands are up and down rather than straight across. 14.5 times the mass of the Earth, or less than 5% the mass of Jupiter. And it's the second least dense planet in our solar system, 1.27 grams per centimeter, where water is exactly one. And then we have Neptune at 17.2 Earth masses, a little more than 5% the mass of Jupiter, and it's a little more massive than Jupiter, 1.638. And what we've been noticing with gas giant planets outside of our solar system, those that are more massive than Jupiter tend to be denser, and those that are less massive than Jupiter tend to be less dense. And we kind of understand why for those that are bigger than Jupiter. The ones that are bigger than Jupiter are going to have a stronger gravity, and that gravity is going to tend to collapse the gases that make up that planet. So, for example, we see planets that are 10 to 20 times the mass of Jupiter, and they're actually denser than the Earth. Earth is the densest of the planets in our solar system, at a little more than 5.5 times the density of water. But there are planets we see outside the solar system that are denser, but they're all planets that are really, really big, what we call super Jupiters. Now, what's led to the discovery that there's something extraordinary about the density of our gas giant planets are transit studies. Until recently, the only method we had for detecting planets outside of our solar system was the radio velocity method, where we kind of look at the star and we measure how fast the star is moving away from us or towards us. And if a planet's orbiting that star, that will cause the planet to move away and come towards us, move away and come towards us as the planet orbits about that star. And so that's been the predominant technique for detecting planets outside of our solar system. But a new technique has developed because of instrumentation, which is basically the transit method. Now you say, what are we talking about with transits? Well, here's an example of a transit. Here we have Venus coming between our observers on planet Earth and the Sun. And so you see here the disk of Venus on the background of the Sun. And actually here we have a double transit where we see Venus and then you got an aircraft flying between the telescope and the Sun. Now, the thing about this transit method is you don't actually have to have an image like this. All you need is a very accurate light measuring device. And what the light measuring device determines is how much the light of the star dims. And so if a planet transits across the star in our line of sight, we will actually be able to see the light of the star dim slightly. Say, by how much? Well, if it's a planet the size of Jupiter, it's going to dim by about 1%. And that's quite easy to measure. We have light detecting devices that can measure one part in 10,000 in terms of luminosity. So you could actually measure a planet as small as the Earth going across the star. In fact, that's really the favored technique for finding planets as small as the Earth, is to use the transit method. Now, so far, we have discovered 64 transiting exoplanets. This is quite new. I mean, 2 years ago, we only had two transiting planets that have been discovered. But because of new telescopes that are dedicated to finding transiting planets, the list is now up to 64. In the last issue of the Astrophysical Journal, they added 5 to that list, brought it from 59 up to 64. Yes?
So you mentioned that 1% change would be easy to detect because of the precision of our instruments. Don't you also have to take into account the fluctuations of the star itself?
Well, yes, stars do fluctuate a little bit. But stars, like the Sun, fluctuate very little. So our Sun, for example, fluctuates by much less than one part in 1,000. And moreover, those fluctuations will even out. And so, and then let me go back to this, because what you're actually going to see, notice that this has got a particular diameter. And so as it transits across the star, you're going to see as it comes in and out of transit that you're going to get a variation in the light. So that's the way you can distinguish it from the variations in the light of the star, because a transit is going to give you a very predictable drop-off in light and an increase in light as it goes in and out of the limb. But as it goes in and out of the limb, that also allows you to measure the diameter of the planet relative to the diameter of the star. And so this gives us new information about planets we never had before. excuse me. You know, with a radio velocity method, you do not get the diameter of the star, and all you get is a lower estimate on the mass of the star. Because after all, you don't know the inclination of the orbit.
The planet.
But if you got both radio velocity information and transit information, you get a whole lot more data. Now we know the mass of the planet, not just its lower bound. And we know the diameter of the planet. Well, if you know the diameter of the planet and the mass of the planet, now you can calculate the density of the planet. And so this is a powerful technique for measuring characteristics of planets that we could never measure before. And by the way, if it's close enough to our telescope, you can even determine the atmospheric components of the planet. And that's only been done on a couple of planets so far, but the goal is that we'd be able to detect, for example, nitrogen or oxygen in the atmosphere of the planet if we can measure the spectrum of that light with sufficient precision. So this transit method has got a lot of promise for telling us about the physical properties of stars or probably planets outside of our solar system. Yes?
But doesn't how big the planet appears have a lot to do with how far or close it is from the star's orbit?
That's true. But your transit, primarily your radio velocity method, is going to be able to tell you that.
Okay.
So, I mean, to get this kind of data, you need both sets of measurements. It's not enough just to have transit data. You need transit data and radio velocity data combined. But radio velocity data is fairly straightforward to achieve. That's kind of easy astronomy. This is more difficult astronomy. And so we do have the transit data. Typically, you get a lot of information about the characteristics of the planet. And that means for the first time, we can test our different models of planet formation from various creation models to various evolution models. Yes?
The other question I had is when you're talking about massive planets that aren't very dense, wouldn't they be harder to find with the first method you were talking about? Because if they are a lot less dense, then their gravity wouldn't be as dense as the mass of the planet.
No, the density does not affect the gravitational pull of the planet. The mass is all you worry about. Mass is the only factor that determines how powerfully that planet will tug on the star. So it doesn't matter how dense it is. It could be big or small. What really counts is the mass. Okay? Now, for the first time, we got enough transiting exoplanet data that we can actually do some kind of analysis. Now, this hasn't been published yet. I mean, all I've done is gone through the catalogs of these exoplanets, pulled out the 64 transiting ones, and looked at their characteristics. But it's already revealing some interesting data. One is that five of these 64 transiting planets are what we call super Jupiters. That would be a planet that's bigger than five times the mass of Jupiter. And like all other super Jupiters that we're seeing, they're very dense. And the physics of the formation of really big gas giants tells us they must be dense. Because, they have powerful gravity, and the gravity is going to condense the planet. And so this is not at all surprising that we have high densities for the five transiting supergiants. That's completely expected. What has been unexpected is the fact that 25 of these 64 are less dense than Saturn. Now, in studying our own solar system planets, we recognize that planets that are less massive than Saturn will tend to be denser, and planets that are more massive than Saturn will be denser. That's kind of standard things you learn in astronomy class, that the mass of Saturn is where you're going to get the minimum density. But this is not what we're seeing here. I mean, the mean mass of these planets that are less dense than Saturn comes in at 0.771 times the mass of Jupiter. And that's about 2.5 times the mass of Saturn. So these planets tend to be more massive than Saturn. The mean density is 0.434, which means compared to Saturn, they're a lot less dense. The least dense of all comes in at 0.123. And that's a real enigma. I mean, right now, planetary scientists can't figure out how you can possibly get a planet that is only one-tenth the density of water. Nevertheless, we found some. Quite a few come in at 0.2 and 0.3. but most of them are coming in at just less than the density of Saturn. But it averages out to 0.434. But the real shock is how massive these planets are that are less dense than Saturn. Yes.
Would this suggest that they contain more hydrogen?
Yes. They would contain, in fact, the only way to get these kinds of densities is that these planets would have to be almost entirely made up of hydrogen and helium. But the universe is 97% hydrogen and helium, or our galaxy is anyway. The universe is about 98%.
So that would suggest that our gas giants would be unique in this universe.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
You know, so as we look at these transiting exoplanets, it's giving us more data showing that indeed the solar system's suite of planets are unique amongst the planets we see in our galaxy. And so it's supporting the conclusions of the theoretical studies where they said, well, in order to explain the sun's unique abundance of elements, it must have a unique suite of planets. And this is giving more evidence in favor of that conclusion. Yes?
You mentioned that standard dogma in your astronomy classes is that Saturn is at the minimum
right
density in terms of mass versus density. Did that come from just looking at the planets in our solar system, or is that based on studies of planetary formation?
Well, planetary formation in a sense is that in order for a planet to be able to accumulate the light stuff, it's got to have a minimum mass. And so Uranus and Neptune are not massive enough that the gravity can collect the really light gases. And so, Uranus and Neptune relative to Saturn will be hydrogen deficient. But Saturn's got adequate gravity that it can grab the hydrogen and it can grab the helium. But now when you get to planets as big as Jupiter, the gravity is so strong that it's able to shrink down or collapse the gas that it collects. And so in that sense, we have at least a heuristic feel for why Saturn is the least dense. I mean, it has the mass, and it's the distance from the star. Distance from the star is a factor, too, because the closer it is to the star, the more heat you're going to have coming from the star, that will tend to drive off the lighter gases. So that's another reason why Jupiter would be a little denser. It's a little closer to the sun, and therefore there's a little more heat to drive off the light gases. But its main factor is it's more than three times more massive than Saturn. And because of its greater mass, it's going to have a stronger gravity.
So if that's based on, at some level on first principles, then wouldn't it mean that the planets that we're discovering outside of our solar system are the unique ones, and ours are the standard ones?
Well, but the problem is it's our solar system planets that stick out like a sore thumb. They don't have the characteristics of all the other ones. Now, this has led to some speculation in the scientific literature. Astronomers are intrigued by this problem and trying to figure out why we're seeing things that don't seem to be fitting our planetary formation field. Now, what the astronomers are saying is that, you know, if all you look at is the solar system planets, you could make the mistake of not taking into account that maybe these other planetary systems had different starting constituents. And that's kind of where the scientific research is going right now. That the only way to explain why our solar system planets are unique is that they had a different formation birthing circumstances than the planets we see elsewhere in our galaxy. And so the research is saying, you know, what is so special about the birthing history of the planets? In other words, they must have started with a different mix of elements than the ones we see outside of our solar system. So they're not questioning the physics. The physics of the star formation or the planetary formation seems well grounded because it's able to predict the statistics we see in these exoplanets, just like it can predict the physics of the planets in our solar system, if we're willing to recognize that you begin with different starting or different initial composition. And so but we already know, for example, that our sun formed in a very dense, large star cluster and got quickly ejected from that star cluster and also formed adjacent to several unique supernova eruption events. And so already we know that there's something special about the way the sun and its planets formed. But where the research is now heading is what would have to be the initial composition of the elements in the nebula that formed our planets relative to the initial composition of the elements that would be in the planetary disks of these exoplanetary systems. That's where we think the answer lies. But right now, we don't have a definitive answer. You know, the research has not yet been done. But this is establishing that we need to do that research because clearly things are showing up as being unique in terms of our solar system gas giant planets relative to the gas giants we see elsewhere. So, yeah, this is all brand new stuff. I mean, only in the last few days, literally, have we had an adequate catalog of the characteristics of transiting exoplanets that we could do this kind of analysis. Yes, Ross.
Is the sample size of extrasolar planets large enough where we can start to draw conclusions from a mathematical standpoint about the chances of finding?
Well, I anticipate that critique, Ross. I mean, I'm doing this, not the astronomers that are publishing the data. A lot of them are taking the wait and see approach, saying, you know, maybe we need to wait until we get a larger sample size. The reason why I jumped on it is the sample size went from 50 to 64 in literally just a few days. So I'm figuring, hey, you know, now we got a sample size that is significant. And I remember when the first of these exoplanets was discovered just a few years ago, and, you know, of the transiting planets, they had, 2 years ago, they had 13 exoplanets, and only two were less dense than Saturn. And in the literature at that time, they were saying these are going to be proved to be anomalies. We don't expect there will be any more than these two. And they're also predicting that the two they had found were due to bad measurements. Nobody believed that we could possibly have planets less dense than Saturn. What has happened since late 2006 is that we now know that indeed these planets are less dense than Saturn. It's not due to bad measurements. Moreover, it's not just two of them. We got 25 of them. And so this is something that obviously needs to be addressed. This isn't an anomaly that's going to go away. It's a permanent feature of the exoplanetary scene. And so I'm just kind of coming to you here just saying there's something here that seems to be interesting and is supportive of the biblical doctrine that God designed, intervened to make sure we had just the right planetary system to make advanced life possible here on planet Earth. Yes?
At the end of 2006, if I remember the stats right, there were about 199 planetary parameters, stellar parameters needed to get a star that would support the first life planet. What is it now?
Oh, I don't know off the top of my head how many stellar characteristics. I mean, I got to hear my computer if you want me to dig it out. Maybe I can dig it out for you. Let me see if I can find it fast. Here we go. Whoops. Launched the wrong program. All right. Where do I go here? Ah. Where's my Seattle events? I did way too much speaking last year. Okay. Here we go. Let's get rid of this. This will be interesting because it's going to have the statistics for a lot more than just a star. But let me dig it out here for you. Okay. Let me pull this back here for you so I can actually see it on my computer. And then, here we go. So to answer your question, 140 different features of a star must be fine-tuned in order for advanced light to be possible, and the probability any given star will have those 140 necessary characteristics is less than one chance in 10 to the 130th power. And the significant point there is that there's only about 50 billion trillion stars in the universe. That's 10 to the 23. So even for the entire universe, your probability of finding a star without invoking divine miraculous intervention would be less than one chance in 10 to the 107th power. So, yeah, so it's relatively remote. And the probability of getting the right planetary system, 137 different features of the planetary system must be fine-tuned in order for light to be possible.
Is this for advanced light or
anything? We're talking advanced light. Okay, if you're talking bacteria, the probabilities aren't quite that remote. They drop. But if you're talking advanced light, and this is particularly true of the planetary system, many planetary systems conceivably could allow for the existence of bacteria surviving for 3 months or less. If you're talking bacteria surviving for billions of years, which is a necessary requirement for advanced life, the probabilities become remote. And so, as I've mentioned here in the class before, every one of the eight planets in our solar system must be critically fine-tuned to make life possible. You can't throw away Neptune. Neptune's a factor. You can't throw away Venus. Venus is a factor. Mars is a factor, all making possible the existence of advanced light. So next year when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might put up a word for Mars, for Mercury, for Venus, for Uranus, Neptune, etc. They're all important for making your Thanksgiving dinner possible.
Can you throw away Pluto now? Is that the stupid one?
You can throw away Pluto. Pluto is not a planet. It's just simply a big asteroid that's sitting out there. And the problem with Pluto is when they first discovered it, they grossly overestimated its size. It's really, we now have Kuiper Belt objects that have been discovered that are bigger than Pluto. And so we had to demote Pluto. Otherwise, our school-age children would be able to memorize the names of 30-plus planets. Now they only have to memorize eight, so it's actually easier for them. But, you know, even our moon, for example, 27 different features must be fine-tuned to make life possible. These figures are as of the end of 2006. I've been too busy writing books to update this. So, I need a 2-month window to update it. I mean, there's thousands of papers we have to go through to get this updated. But what we can see in our website, however, is every time we do update it, the odds get more remote from a naturalistic perspective, and typically get remote at a rate that exceeds about a factor of a million per month. Every month, the evidence gets a million times stronger. So, anyway, let me, how much time we got left?
30 seconds.
2 minutes, oh boy. Okay. We might just let this go at this because I'm not sure it'd be worth it to get into Psalm 104. I did leave you with some homework. We did get through that part of Psalm 104 where we talked about the redemptive analogy argument, how we see in Psalm 104 the message that God removes life and he replaces that life, which is really a redemptive analogy for the crucifixion and the resurrection, and how that's something we see in the culture and the historical background and the legends of every culture group in the world. But evidently, it's also showing up in the creation history of our planet and the life here on the planet. As it says at the end of Psalm 104, it's a property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth and actually must do so given the physics that he chose in order to keep life here. In other words, the pathway to sustain life on planet Earth is death. And that's something you see through the New Testament epistles. We can't gain life unless we're prepared to die. It's through death that we gain eternal life. Just as a seed must separate itself from the tree and die in order to fulfill its destiny, likewise we must die to fulfill our destiny, and likewise we see that in all creation. that the cycle of life and death is crucial to sustaining life and making advanced life possible. But then the last five verses of Psalm 104 are really an exhortation about our meditation. May my meditation be pleasing to him as I rejoice in the Lord, the psalmist says here. And what he's really referring to is the content of Psalm 104. And we study the creation history. We need to look for opportunities in that research to give praise to the Lord, rejoice in what he has done. I can put it this way. May my scientific research be pleasing to him as I rejoice in the Lord. May my theological research be pleasing to him as I rejoice in the Lord. And I will sing to the Lord all my life. I will sing praise to my God as long as I live. And we are to be always looking for reasons to praise God as we study the book of nature, as we study the book of Scripture. So that should be a technique for reading the Bible and reading the record of nature. Got a lot more to say about this before we jump into Psalm 139, but I'll leave that to next week. And by the way, Psalm 139 is the one creation account that we have that focuses entirely on human beings. The whole creation account is focusing on the origin of humanity and how God set up humans as distinct from all life here on planet Earth. As I've mentioned earlier, when you look at Genesis chapter 1, there are three origins of life. There is the origin of physical life, the origin of soulish life, and the origin of spiritual life. And Psalm 139 addresses the origin of spiritual life and actually deals with a lot of the controversial issues we're facing today. When does life begin? Psalm 139, it begins at conception. That's when we become a spiritual being, which is why the Christian community has always opposed abortion. Because, you know, it's not just when the child comes out of the womb that it's a person, a spiritual being that God created to live forever. That happens at the moment of conception. Psalm 139, we'll be getting into that in the next few weeks. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the time we've had looking at some of these amazing discoveries about planets outside of our solar system, how for the first time we're discovering details that never before have been revealed. And Lord, we praise you that the greater detail we study your book of nature, the more evidence we find there for your handiwork in revealing yourself through that book. And likewise, Lord, we recognize the same is true of the book of Scripture, that the more detail in which we study it, the more we see your hand of revelation towards us of your plan of salvation and redemption. In Jesus' name, amen.